How do some of the world's sharpest minds start their day? By putting their brain first. And it's not just our secret leaders who kick off every day with heights. From Stephen Fry to best-selling author and fellow podcaster Dr. Rangan Chatterjee, who give us rave reviews. So if you care about your brain's health and cognitive potential, think heights. Listeners can get 25% off their first month with the code LEADERSHEIGHTS at www.yourheights.com.
Hello, and welcome back to The Secret Lives of Leaders, and a big thank you for making it to episode 3.
Well done.
Shows some dedication. Our guest today is Graham Hobson of Photobox fame.
How did you manage to, before we start, how did you manage to get such an accomplished entrepreneur in?
So I think the real question is, how did I get such an accomplished entrepreneur to invest in my business? That's
true.
Definitely the bigger question. I managed to meet Graham at an event about a year ago, and I did what I always do, which is talk incessantly.
Did you still tell him about your cats?
Yeah, I definitely told him about my cats. He's got cats. We definitely bonded about cats. It's hard for me to bond with people that don't have cats because I've got very little left to like me for. But beyond that, I was talking about mobile, and he was talking about the struggles they've had at mobile at Photobox. And if I'm completely honest, within 2 weeks of having met him for the first time, he'd signed papers, put his money in, and given us his full backing. And actually, you know, I have to say he's been one of the best investors we've ever had because he's an entrepreneur. He doesn't mess around, doesn't waste your time. So he's either in or out, and either supports you or he doesn't. And he's incredibly proactive regularly, always emails. I mean, he emailed me a minute ago on a Sunday afternoon. So he's just always there thinking. So he's lovely. Like, such a nice guy.
So in today's podcast, yeah, Graham is, as Dan mentioned, the co-founder of Photobox. And, you know, if you haven't heard of Photobox and you live in the UK, you've been living under a rock. One of the biggest online photo printing companies out there. What's quite interesting also that his company bought Moonpig, Nick Jenkins' Moonpig, that we interviewed in episode 1.
Very true. So that's not generally the theme of how we go for it. It's not all big fish eating little fish and interviewing both sides of the story. But it's quite nice because we get a little insight into that as well in today's episode. So, you know, I think maybe we'll just crack on. What do you think, Rich?
Yep. Sit back, get a glass of coffee or wine. Drinks out of glass when you have coffee?
Well, you don't drink coffee, so this is why you have apps. And you've literally got a flask in front of me, so you've probably never seen a glass or a coffee.
Let's get on with it.
All right.
From Runway East Studios in London, welcome to The Secret Lives of Leaders.
Today's guest is a very inspiring, down-to-earth, digital printing entrepreneur, Graham Hobson. A quick Google search of Graham Hobson will reveal he was voted the best wedding and corporate entertainment band in the Gold Coast of Australia. However, upon further inspection, the real Graham Hobson is perhaps more interested in technology than music, despite having a Wikipedia page entry as the head coach for the University of Richmond in Virginia in 1902.
Not true either.
Not true?
No.
How do you know that?
Well, it's not me.
Okay. So, Graham, I know you'll say you're old on occasions, but you're not that old. So to help our listeners find the right one online, you are, in fact, Graham Hobson of Photobox fame, are you not?
Correct.
Fantastic. You may not be the first Graham Hobson, as it turns out, but you're probably the most successful, seeing as your namesake only ever recorded 3 wins and went down as Richmond's 16th most successful coach of the 1900s. But anyway, we digress. Photobox. The idea was simple. Allow customers to print their most meaningful photos, such as their babies and families, onto physical products such as calendars and mugs from the comfort of their own home. Back in 1999, when he conceived the idea, it was truly original. And when they went live in 2000, they made £2.70 on their first day. 16 years later, they still have that very same customer, though the business has been through some huge changes. With an undisclosed but not impossible to find online suggested exit of a few hundred million pounds, and over 1,000 employees later, I think it's fair to call Graham one of the UK's most successful entrepreneurs. So it's a treat to have you on the show, Graham.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Thank you. So first things first, to get you in the mood, and of course to throw you off topic so you're immediately uncomfortable, please answer some of these quick fire questions for us.
Okay.
Cats or dogs?
Cats.
Good answer.
Tough answer, though. I grew up with dogs, have a cat now. But go with cats.
Great answer. I wish everyone was like you, Graham. Donald Trump or Vladimir Putin?
So this is a best of the worst outcome. You know, lesser of two evils.
Well, one do you love more?
I guess, theoretically, we could get rid of Trump in 4 years, right? So I'll go with him.
Okay. Photos or music?
I have to say photos.
Okay. Do you? Is that how you feel, or you just feel like that's best for your stock price?
They're both important to me, but okay. Stock price wins.
Okay. Democrat or Republican?
Democrat.
Some hesitation there? Any reason?
Well, it has to make sense, right? You know, and you have to be quite close to the middle. It has to be in the rational zone. So, yeah, I have Democrat tendencies, but, you know, there are times when you have to veer off course.
Okay, safety first.
Yeah.
Alcohol or drugs?
Alcohol.
CTO or CEO, as you've been both?
CTO. Or possibly CPO.
Okay, interesting. Well, yeah. That's not really a straight-up answer. If you could only do one for the rest of your life, which would it be?
It has to be CTO, more toys.
Fair enough.
Less investors.
Favourite musician?
I can't say. That's what Spotify's for.
Let's just say Leonard Cohen to honour him this week. Okay. City life or countryside life?
Oh, definitely city life. Unless there's a zombie apocalypse, and then country life will probably be safer.
So country life too boring for you?
No, I'm an urban person. My wife is too. We just love soaking up cities and being in the centre of things.
Fair play. So high end or high street?
High street, definitely.
We were talking about your jacket the other day, so you look like
I'm at
that one, I believe.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I just don't get expensive clothing. I'm sure people do, but, you know, it's like, you find something that fits and buy it. That's it.
Thank God for my business model. Yeah. Thank God for my business model. Some people do care about expensive clothing.
Oh, yeah, oops.
You should be encouraging people to spend a bit more. So, well-paid corporate job or do it all again?
Do it all again.
Good answer. Okay. Before you started, you and your co-founder, Mark Chapman, were both working in banking together in the 90s, which was a famous time for the capital, if not for all the right reasons, obviously. Were there any fun stories you could share with us about your time spent in the very seedy, high-paid world of investment banking?
I'm not sure I want to commit any to an archive. I mean, it was a time full of excess. Banking
there's
was...
There's already a few stories in an archive somewhere about the time.
Yeah, I mean, it was like a startup industry in London and I'm sure elsewhere in the world. You know, banks were building these huge trading floors and investing really heavily and hiring quite irrational people to work in them. I mean, very kind of high dopamine, living in the moment, people who would be, you know, perhaps excellent traders, but couldn't restrain themselves in other parts of their lives. So yeah, I've seen it all. If anybody's ever read Liar's Poker by Michael Lewis, I think he also wrote The Big Short. It just rings so true. You recognize it all, and I've definitely seen lots of bad behavior, but also it was a great period for me and learning how business works and how technology can go into very rapid cycles. So I loved it. Great.
You also came into close contact with the famous rogue trader indeed, Nick Leeson.
I did. So I was working for a small consulting company, and then I had a chance to do a contract, and it was in a software package called Holos, which I'd never heard of, but I got kind of trained one Sunday and turned up on the Monday as an expert in bearing securities.
Does sound like a startup.
And they had no space on the trading floor, so they put me into a little quad of desks in the settlements area, and sitting opposite me was Nick Leeson. I think this was probably a few months before he went out to Singapore. So yeah, I got to know him, and nice guy, and was amazed like everybody when everything happened.
So he didn't have any sort of twinkle in his eye of ultimate cheekiness that brought down a whole bank?
I think we all had that twinkle in our eye at the time, but his was more impactful than the rest of us.
Is it fair to just say that ultimately he was the most entrepreneurial of all of you?
Yeah, in the wrong direction, though. Yeah,
absolutely. Okay, so you moved on from the immoral playground and into not quite so glamorous world of entrepreneurialism yourself. So 16 years at the same company. Can you give us a synopsis of how you started?
I think like a lot of entrepreneurial activity, it started because I had a need in my own life. I had two young kids at the time and took lots of pictures with my wife. And I thought, you know, I'm going to Boots every couple of weeks with a roll of film, and most of the results aren't that good. I'd like to get a digital camera, plus it's a gadget, would have been cool. And so I bought a Sony camera, and really, you know, to cut a long story short, just found that there was nowhere to get prints, nowhere online in UK, in Europe. I found one company in the States called pix.com. It's not there anymore. But you know, there was nothing. And I thought, well, it can't be that difficult. If you can go into any high street chemist and there's a mini lab there, why not buy one of those mini labs, connect it to a website, and off you go. And it really felt like a kind of order management system like I would have built in one of the banks, but with a mini lab at the end. So started to write a business plan, kept on expecting Kodak and Fuji and anyone else to launch anytime now.
And you wrote this business plan on the tube, didn't you?
I wrote it on the tube on the way into work. I think it was around October 99. And it just, you know, kept going. I was ready to give up at any point. The real driver for me was I wanted the service. If somebody else provided it, I would have been perfectly happy. And then it just got to the point where, you know, I had a plan. It was quite well formed. I started to talk to people I work with who said, yeah, we'd back you if you did this. So at the end of 2000, after a bit of arm wrestling with Mark, who wasn't so keen on the idea, we went for it. And yeah, very, very, very slow start. And you mentioned the £2.70 sales on our launch day. I think we had a few 0 days after that. You know, we really were two guys in a shabby space in the Clerkenwell area with a mini lab and some made up desks, and we were just kind of winging it.
Did either of you know anything beforehand about printing photos?
So Mark had a dark room when he was a teenager, I think, and so he had a bit of experience, but none of us had any professional experience. And in fact, one of the things I wanted to do was to go and find a professional partner, like a pro lab, that would know what they were talking about and help advise us. So we did that. We gave away a little bit of equity, but found an excellent company called Metro Imaging in Clerkenwell, who were specializing in fashion photography, really, to be our credentials and our advisors. And that really helped get us started.
I'm picking up for this mic.
Hmm?
I've got a
mic
here.
Oh, great.
How long did it take you to build the original product?
So I remember, you know, we wrote the business plan, had enough to go and out and raise money with that. And then I, over the kind of Christmas and New Year period of 2000, the start of 2000, I was writing a spec effectively for the website. I think I wrote that in a week. We put it out to tender. There were so many new media companies popping up at the time, and some of them were really expensive and promising the earth. And in the end, we went with a really small company outside of London who said they could do everything for us, you know, hardware, hosting, build the website, run some aspects of the service. And for the most part, it was a total disaster. And we ended up, you know, doing a painful exit out of that contract. But they put us in touch with an excellent contractor who built the website in 6 weeks. Mm. And he's still employed at Photobox today. And he's like one of the key drivers of our innovation over that time.
Pretty impressive. Yeah. So out of a negative outcome, you had a positive influence in the company. So within 4 weeks, you'd raised £500,000, but it took you 5 years to raise again. So I think that's a nice little lesson for entrepreneurs that are coming up now who get obsessed about when to raise, how to raise, and how hard it can be. Can you explain what was going on in that time and how did you get by?
Yeah, so I think we originally said we would raise between £240,000 and £480,000. And looking back, the £240,000 was completely naive. We couldn't have done anything with that. But as it was, there was a lot of interest, and we got to £480,000 within a week. And in fact, I was sending back some checks. We thought we're not going to get more than that. It would just be difficult to manage. So we raised that money, but it was a different time to now. A lot of the infrastructure we take for granted today with AWS or Office Space or whatever just didn't exist. We had to do everything from scratch. We had to go out and buy hardware. We couldn't get a lease agreement for the mini lab, which cost us £140,000. So we had to pay cash for that because nobody would trust the startup at this time.
£140,000 payment
for a
in
printer.
Cash for a printer from the £480,000 raise.
Yeah.
That's ridiculous.
So the money went down very, very quickly. But we were very lean, and we hired one guy to help us. But
very lean despite spending £140,000 on a printer.
Well, we were lean on our monthly burn rate. Let's put it that way. Yeah. So you know, it was all going well, and but we did have in mind that by the summer, 6 months into the project, we'd have to go out and raise more. And during that time, lastminute.com had done their float, and then everybody had declared the, you know, the end of the bubble, and suddenly the market became incredibly hostile to B2C businesses. And we just, you know, all the angels went away. VC funds, we were too small for them. So I think our original dream, which was build the service, launch it, but actually get rid of it quite quickly, you know, 1 year in and out, was gone. We knew we were going to be in a slower cycle. We did line up one investor, one kind of big, high net worth, you know, family trust to come in. And it all looked good. We agreed the price and the terms. But
did you meet him from work?
So it was one of our first round investors who was, you know, a guy in the city. And he was representing a Middle Eastern family who were personal friends of his. And he basically pledged to invest £1 million in us for 20% of the company. So we thought that was great progress. Yeah. Agreed terms. And the money never turned up. We kept chasing it, but there were all kinds of issues in the transfer and the origins and the money laundering conditions that needed to be satisfied. Not that there was anything wrong with the money. It's just it had been parked for so long that it didn't have credentials. So we just realized after about 6 weeks of chasing this, we were going to have to give up on it and do something else. So in fact, we did raise some money, but we went back to our first round investors and did what's called a rights issue, which is we give them the right to participate in a down round. It was quite an aggressive down round because we were running very short. They did that. We raised another $100,000. And actually, that saw us through to cash flow break even a few months later. And we didn't need to raise again until, well, a process that started in 2005. But I think that was for different reasons.
What was break even at that point? Like, what was your revenue kind of?
So it was tiny. I mean, I remember talking to people in the company more recently.
So there were only three of you, weren't there?
Yeah, there were three. And I think even after 3 years, there were only five of us or something like that. But I remember showing somebody in the last couple of years a graph of daily revenues from PhotoBox for the first 5 years. And it took us 18 months to get to the first £1,000 day. And it took us, in all of the first 5 years, we only had one day that was more than $25,000. So it was a really, really slow increase, steady increase, but no hockey sticks. And in fact, you know, I think if I had any regrets, it's that we were too satisfied with that steady, slow, small business growth, and we should have accelerated things a lot earlier.
And why was that? Was that just because that was your mindset, because there was no other desire, or because you didn't really know better?
I think we were just super conservative, both Mark and I. And maybe, you know, there are many ways in which we're different personalities and did different things within the business, but we were both very cautious, and we didn't want, in a way, I had no doubt the business would succeed, but I just felt it needed time. And the last thing we wanted to do was to burn out of cash. And we were seeing lots of competitors at the time come in very aggressively, spend lots of money, and then disappear 6 months later. And we thought, we're not going to be one of those.
So you went for staying power.
Yeah.
You say you regret that, but it's been a success. Do you regret that because you think it could be more success, or you could have done it in less time?
I think we could have done it in less time. I mean, in retrospect, obviously it's easy to say that, but it's... Yeah, I think we were too patient, waiting 5 years for any kind of next stage event in the growth of the company.
It was quite tricky, though, because, yes, I can see where you're coming from. At the same time, with industry stuff like this, where there's a few competitors, longevity and survival is basically 9/10 of the law. If you can outlast.
It is. We did have about 23 investors at the beginning, and half of them were, you know, city professionals who were very relaxed. They could see it was going okay. I think investors have always described us as kind of mid-range boring. We're never going to be an Instagram. We weren't burning out of cash. We were kind of boring in the middle. And the professionals could see that was a nice, steady contribution to their portfolio. But the less experienced investors were saying, you know, come on, guys, it's been 5 years. You know, what are you going to do to get me any kind of return? And some of them were approaching retirement age and kind of on our backs every month, and we did feel that pressure.
So when you finally did your larger round, what was the actual story behind how you became more than just PhotoBox, but a whole group? Because you decided to raise a round as part of a wider story, correct?
Yeah, kind of. It's a kind of personal thing. In 2005, I think my patience was running out. I was personally running out of money. There was a lot of sacrifice that went into running this small business for 5 years. I'd given up. You know, Mark and I had both given up good careers in the city. We had young kids. You know, it's getting to that kind of peak point of expense in a family cycle. And I was thinking, you know what, we've either got to raise more or give up. And the best story for me to conceive of doing that was to go to move into Europe. Because I think at this point, by being the tortoise and, you know, going slow and steady, we'd got to be UK number one. We did a lot of white label deals with ISPs and we'd covered most of the big ones in the UK. So we had this number one slot in the UK, but it wasn't enough to make us feel satisfied. So we thought, let's move into Europe. Let's go raise money to move into Europe. So we lined up a small AIM listing with a bank. And the secret was we couldn't do it organically. We had to go out and find somebody to acquire. So we found a small Swiss company that was covering lots of countries. They seemed like a perfect fit for us. We agreed terms. This is probably mid-2005. And went over to do due diligence. And I discovered that, you know, whilst kind of diving into their database, they had an orders table with lots of zeros in it for tax, and they'd never paid any tax on their orders, which was a kind of a bit of a glitch. They thought, being a Swiss company, they didn't have to, but in fact, they were, you know, shipping to the EU and manufacturing in the EU. So we realized this was going to be a huge problem. The deal fell apart.
Fans of Brexit were following Switzerland for, hoping that we won't have to pay tax again as well.
Yeah, no, it doesn't work like that. But the deal fell apart and we kind of thought, well, we've got this AIM listing ready to go. Let's call our nearest competitor in France and see if they want to do a deal. We phoned them up, a company called PhotoWays, very, very similar to PhotoBox. Two guys started it at the same time. And we explained the situation to them and they said, well, instead of you buying us, why don't we buy you? We've just raised some US VC money. And that's what we ended up doing. And that closed in April 2006.
Well, it's quite an unusual acquisition story because you then carried on being PhotoBox and ultimately you guys were the ones running the show. So how did that actually transcribe? Because from my limited knowledge, that does sound quite unusual.
Well, there's a lot of kind of grey areas in mergers and acquisitions, and the terminology is largely irrelevant most of the time. They ended up buying us because several factors. One was they'd gone out and raised the VC money, so they had the cash in the bank. The second thing was, even though they started at the same time as us with the same business model, they'd gone for that more aggressive marketing-led, discounting-led approach. So they'd actually achieved more growth in those 5 years than we had. Not a lot more, but a bit more. And so it became more of a kind of 60-40 thing. So we were very happy to be acquired by them, but it was clear that on day one of the merged entity, we were going to be running it or very actively involved in running it. And we also made a decision collectively that the PhotoBox name would play better across Europe than PhotoWays. Mm-hmm. And then the two founders of PhotoWays, not immediately, but you know, over the next few months, decided to move on anyway and wanted to do other startups. And we brought in a new CEO at the time, a guy called Stan, who stayed with us for 10 years in the end, and brought all the experience that I think Mark and I were missing in terms of getting the company to the next level.
And were you guys able to take some exit cash at the time and return an exit to some of your investors through that acquisition?
Yeah. So actually, you know, it was very much on our minds that we wanted to get something for those first round investors who'd been very patient for 6 years in the end. And they got a good return, very healthy, you know, return. And for the UK ones, it was tax-free. Mark and I got a bit off it in a way. What was first offered or what we first kind of agreed to was very small. It would have just, you know, cleared a few debts. Then we realized that the risk factors were higher and we bumped it up a bit, but it wasn't by any means a life-changing amount. But yeah, we were happy. And we had I think one of the smartest things we did was we asked what the strategy was for the new company. And one of the answers that came back was, well, we're going to sell it quite quickly. And we said, how confident are you? And they said, very confident. And we said, just in case you don't sell it, can we have a contract that says we have a right to sell you more shares if you don't? And that, Mark and I think back as one of the best things we did, because the sale didn't go through, but then we had a right to sell more shares a couple of years later. So at least we got a bit more out.
At the same price that you...
at an improved valuation? Or?
I think it was the same price, but it, you know, one of the issues sometimes when you merge with a bigger company is it's a paper transaction. You get shares in the new company and people say, believe in us, you know, we'll all do well at the end. But if that exit is a long time out, then you're waiting a long time. So just being able to sell any shares, you know, as a founder, your shares have always gone up enormously in value anyway, from nominal to a market value. So it was still a good deal.
So along the way, you did buy quite a few other companies, and arguably you actually bought a brand bigger than your own in Moonpig.
Yes.
So was that an especially exciting moment? How did that one come about? And how was your, was that your favorite acquisition, or how can you sort of describe that? Because obviously for UK listeners, that's a very, very recognized brand with a very, very catchy jingle.
Yeah, I think I got asked to go and speak at my school a couple of years ago at their prize giving day. And in preparation for it, they said, would you mind just talking about Moonpig? Because that's the only brand the kids know. So we know it has that very high recognition. It is a special deal. So I knew Nick Jenkins right at the beginning of PhotoBox. That started around the same time. We even outsourced our card production to them at one point and used to go and collect cards, a box of cards every day, and they were printing them. We did think about merging the two companies together in, I think, around 2003 or four, but it felt too expensive at the time. And then I think we ended up paying 60 times the original price that we thought was too expensive.
And talking about multiples, I actually saw Nick Jenkins last week, and he was telling me how he managed to come up with a business essentially where he bought paper at 3p and sold it at £3.
Yes.
Making him one of the most investable businessmen for VCs around, because who else has 100 times margin?
I think there's a few other bits and pieces involved in his cogs, but yeah, it was still a very profitable company.
Hopefully
high growth.
He didn't tell you those cogs until you bought it.
But no, it was great. And I think we were starting to think about, you know, what's the right way of getting to the next stage with PhotoBox, or exiting or listing or something in 2010. We were exploring all of those options, and we came to the conclusion in 2010, we were a bit subscale, that we were too focused on one particular segment of personalization, you know, in the European markets, but we needed to be bigger. We needed to get to a certain scale of turnover and profitability, and Moonpig was kind of the answer to that, by plugging in their turnover, their growth, their profitability, and the fact that they were a very complementary business, also doing, you know, emotional products, personalization, sharing a lot of the logistics that we used, printing and shipping, customer services, web e-commerce. It was just a really great fit. And people often ask me, because it was, you know, a high price paid, do we ever regret it? And never for a moment, not for a day. I think it transformed us, made us a much more durable proposition. And we, you know, we're really still proud of that. And the culture that Moonpig brought into the company as well.
How many employees did they bring in with them?
I can't remember at the time. Maybe it was around 40 or 50, including production staff, something like that.
Okay, and you all moved into the same office?
Eventually, yeah. They had an office in Bankside, and PhotoBox was moving around a lot. We had an office in Paddington at the time, and eventually we moved into a kind of super office in Bankside, and it's very recognisable as the culture of Moonpig as it was then.
Right, and when you're acquiring companies along the way, and they've all got different cultures, you know, is that something that you found really hard as a founder, sort of understanding whether you change the culture to make it more suitable for all the different companies, or you force existing cultures into your own?
I think you have to be very sensitive to it. You know, people, employees of a company are very defensive of their culture, and they always fear when there's M&A that somebody's going to steamroller through and destroy it. Or they assume the kind of worst motives about changes in the organization, when in fact, you know, as one of the leadership team, we looked and just wanted to take the best of each company and preserve that. And there was nothing, no hidden agenda to that. And I think in time, everybody understood that and it all worked out really well. But you do have to be very careful, because whatever you say, people think, oh, that'll be gone, you know, in a month's time.
So as someone who's sold his company in the hundreds of millions, but has also actually done so many funding rounds along the way that you once told me you couldn't even count them, do you actually have any lessons for anyone attracted to this kind of journey to think about before they venture too far down that path? Because it might sound very glamorous to hear the hundreds of millions, but actually the 16 years, the many funding rounds, the ups, the downs, you know, the 5 years of no funding, you know, there's a lot more to it than the exit story.
Yeah, I think you have to be patient and very flexible. You know, I'm a technologist fundamentally, but I love the business side of it. And that's why I found working in a startup easy and rewarding, because you get to see all aspects of the business. You know, at various points we've been doing the customer services, we've obviously been doing the product a lot, and the printing, and you kind of have your hands on everything. And I think to last with a company as it goes through these different phases of evolution, you have to be similarly flexible. Even today, I'm diving into stuff that isn't on my job description, but I do it because it's useful and, you know, enjoyable. So I think you have to be flexible.
Okay, so next section, just getting behind the person a little bit, behind the story. So just starting up, you look like a dodgy character. Have you ever been arrested?
I've never been arrested. No, I'm a very good person, very good citizen. I have been cautioned by naval intelligence, though, once for some hacking activity when I was 17. But actually, I was helping them because I kind of uncovered some urban pipe bombing, you know, activist's account on a mainframe in Virginia. And they came over, and living in the UK, it's a bit weird to have US naval intelligence turn up at your house, but they did.
You lived with your parents?
I was living with my parents.
You cheating yourself?
Well, it was just a bit bizarre, and they kind of came up, looked at my computer, took away printouts and things, and then said, you know, you really shouldn't be poking around US computers. But that's as bad as it got. So
still the most interesting close to arrest story that we've had so far. So can you share an interesting fact that no one knows about you that's not that one? So that's probably one.
I'm not sure what it would be. Oh, I have a Florida driving license.
And why?
That is a good one. That's a really good one.
Because when I was 17, my parents owned an apartment near Fort Lauderdale in Florida, and in the middle of my A-levels, I'm not particularly academic person. I didn't enjoy school and A-levels and stuff. In the middle of my A-levels, I thought it would be more fun to go and live in Fort Lauderdale for a year than to continue doing A-levels. So I just went out there and I had to get a driving license. And eventually, I think reality pulled me back, and I did come back. And it was a miracle, but I got a grade C and a grade E in my A-levels, which is a pass, was a pass back in 1983.
In case anyone wants to know why the banking system eventually failed, it's because people like Graham got really senior jobs with a C and an E at A-level. It says a lot. It's okay. It's not your fault, it's the system.
Yeah, so that was my brief foray into being an almost US citizen.
Is there a pass now?
I don't know. It's not great, is it? I mean,
no, it's not, but I thought F was a fail.
It might be.
Yeah.
I've got three sons, and only one of them's doing computer science. He's studying at Bristol, and he's like an A-star student, so he gets it all from his mother, clearly. But it is really hard. He's thrown into, you know, coding for the first time, writing, you know, elegant C programs compared to some other colleagues on the course who've been writing code for 8 years. Mm-hmm. So he's finding it. He's gone back to the beginning again. But I guess that's the point of uni, right? Take you through those first phases.
It is. Or, you know, just waste your time and stop you from becoming the entrepreneur you should be.
Well, he's doing plenty of that. I went to University of Westminster. Yeah. Okay. So having decided that I'd finish A-levels, get a proper job, I ended up going and doing a degree in computer science.
Did you get into banking straight after your university degree?
I did the milk round, which is where you get offered, you know, jobs when you come out of uni. And at the time, there was still kind of full employment in the city. And I got offered two jobs. One was for a tech company in High Wycombe, which actually sounded more interesting. And the second one was working for the London Stock Exchange, which sounded really boring. Mm. And my dad said, you got to take the LSE one. And I did. And it was great, a great 2 years. In fact, they taught me to be an Oracle application developer, which is a bit boring. But it was a huge foundation in, you know, the reality of databases, data modeling, understanding client needs, and it was great. I went from there to a short period of consulting and then into my contracting in the city.
Yeah, so a kind of corporate start, really. I mean, very corporate start. So do you actually see yourself as an entrepreneur? Do you look back now, or do you look back at it historically and say, my career and my persona suit me thinking of myself as an entrepreneur? Or, you know, how does that kind of, how does it sit with you?
Mixed, really. I mean, I recognize the label that other people give me. I kind of think that entrepreneurs, for me, it feels like people who've done it more than once, because that proves you've got the mindset, right? I could have just been lucky or been the type of person that doesn't want to move around very much. So, but I think you have to be willing to take on risk. I think at school and uni, I didn't really kind of want to fall in with, you know, Cubs and Scouts and group activities, and wanted to do things my own way. And I think that's a skill that's quite common in entrepreneurs. So I recognize I have the mindset for it, but maybe after I've done another startup, somebody should say, then you're an entrepreneur.
Right, okay, that's interesting. So it's more about the bug.
Yeah, I think so.
And the serial element to it.
Yeah, I think that's when you really earn your credentials, because I think the ability to take an idea and transform it into a business model that works and prove that you weren't just lucky the first time. I mean, you don't manage one football club and be called a football manager, right?
That's true, but it's interesting because now you've just given a distinction on success. And of course, success might not come for a lot of entrepreneurs their fifth or sixth, seventh, eighth time. And you would think of them potentially as more entrepreneurial than you because they've done it more.
Yeah.
But, you know, is that a whole distinguished difference between being a British mindset entrepreneur than an American one, where in America, if you fail, you're fucking great as long as you do it again?
I remember going to, I went to Founders, the side event of Web Summit three years ago.
Yeah.
And it was about a group of 150 of us there. And I was really pleased to be there. But I found that nearly everybody there was on like their third exit. And I was still plugging away with Photobox with no real exit in sight. And I did feel like I was, you know, a C grader at that event.
Interesting. Do you know what entrepreneur actually means?
Well, I presume it's the French term, you know, to take between, to bring together two halves.
It's funny because we get a different definition every time.
I think that is actually the right one.
Is that the right one? Rich, do you want to let Graham know what you thought it was last time? After actually searching.
We Googled it last time and it was French construction worker. But that was definitely wrong. That's definitely wrong. So, but yeah, I think your answer was much better.
But we did spend a whole entire interview determined that was correct.
Tell people that.
Oh yeah, sorry. It's recorded. It's recorded.
I've edited it out.
So how do you see yourself? As in, if you don't think of yourself as an entrepreneur, how do you see yourself? How do you label yourself, so to speak?
I don't know. I'm just, you know, a kind of positive, flexible person that's willing to dive into any situation. And I think the people I work with find me useful for that reason. But that's a very positive spin. The other side of it is that I can be very dogmatic and very focused and very kind of, I think we really need to do it this way. And I'm aware, particularly now, in you know, having been at the company so long, that people give my word too much weight. Mm. And that can sometimes kind of stifle the conversation or the creativity in the room. So I'm trying to use it more sparingly.
Fair. Modest. On that note then, if we asked your co-founder, Mark Chapman, who probably knows you best of all, how would he describe you as a person and how would he describe you as an entrepreneur?
I think Mark and I are very different, and that's why it worked. You know, he was very solid on operations and process and was constantly thinking, if this is going to be a real company, where do we need to be in 2 years and how do we get there? And I was all about, what deal can we do today and how can we get more orders in the next 2 days? You know, I was very in the moment. And I think he saw me as somewhat erratic and volatile. And I remember in a slightly heated moment, he described me as immature. But we're great friends. And I think that complementary nature really, really works for us.
So what's quite funny is how you just said that he would describe you, but actually how he described you as an entrepreneur, having asked him, is a natural startup guy, creative, driven, calm, and pragmatic, which is almost all of the opposite of what you just said.
I think I've learned that from him.
Yeah. These, together with an almost unnatural productivity, delivers enormous amounts in short timescales. Which probably, you know, that final part probably relates to that impatience that you might have for getting shit done. But just to follow with the theme and see how well you know yourself. So how would he describe you as a person?
He's probably being super polite when he talks
probably,
to you.
Probably,
so.
Probably.
Yeah, he's talking about the singer in Australia. how would he describe me? I don't know. Energetic.
Okay.
And annoying.
Yeah,
he's described you as tired and very.
He said your 3 wins, 3 draws, and 3 losses marked a terrible career as a football coach. No, so he described you as loyal, honest, great with people, and a good listener. So
I'll accept that.
Yeah.
I do try and be very non-political. It just doesn't help anything or anyone. And it was interesting merging with the French company because I think our French colleagues were very, very suspicious about these Brits rolling into town and assumed we had this hidden agenda and were very political. And it's taken me many years to convince them otherwise.
Fair. So you're a successful guy. What does success feel like now? And does it feel different to how it used to? Do you actually feel successful?
So life since we did the sale to private equity this year really doesn't feel any different. It's nice to de-risk your life and it's nice to kind of know that you've got to that certain almost artificial success criteria, but it doesn't feel very different.
I mean, it is ultimately a label, right?
So. Yeah, I think a key thing for me was, we live in West London. London's an expensive city, and we wanted to have a slightly bigger house, like one spare room for visitors, one extra bathroom.
And West London's the nicest part of London.
I think many people would disagree, but it is a nice part of London. And we just wanted to get a nice family house, nothing extravagant. And back in 2011, we managed to buy a fairly run-down house and then spent the next 2 years doing it up. But that was my only objective. I'm not a yacht guy. I'm not a Maserati guy. We have a 9-year-old Renault Scenic and I have my micro scooter. That's it. I think the other thing is, in the early days of Photobox, we were so short of cash that we gave up like buying posh coffees and going to cafes, and like my kids couldn't take them for a hot chocolate at the weekend. It was that, you know, kind of tough. And so buying a coffee every morning feels like that kind of
luxury.
That feels like success.
Okay, that's nice. So I guess the comparison is to respect the little things.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so who do you actually think is successful? Is there someone that you look up to as an entrepreneur or various people, or it doesn't even have to be a company founder, but who do you think of as successful when you think of that word?
I guess there's lots of different ways of measuring success. I love it when you see people who love what they're doing or have big dreams and they're progressing towards them. You know, I love the fact that Elon Musk is thinking so big and making progress. I mean, like, if you were going to go out and buy an EV today, would you go with, you know, Renault, who are probably dabbling with it, or would you go with Tesla, who really clearly understand this market?
And, depends on what it is.
Yeah. Well, it does.
And it depends if I want to take me to Mars or not.
But no, I think it's great that he's moving the needle forward, and I admire people who set big dreams and make progress towards them.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Pretty common person, but I think that actually just demonstrates how impressive he is to so many people and how aspirational.
Yeah, I also have huge admiration for people who follow artistic endeavor. You know, like I play a bit of music. My kids are much better than me. They're really good. But
what do you play?
A bit of guitar, you know, kind of busking stuff. But I would love to be able to just like go in and play something or perform in a band. And I never will. I'm just not that kind of person. But I have huge admiration for people who can do that. And so that's another form of success.
Hmm.
Just quickly going back to Elon Musk. What's your opinion on the strategy that entrepreneurs should take in terms of like focusing on stuff versus being broad with stuff? Like, he's running 2-3 perhaps companies. Jack Dorsey, Square, Twitter.
Yeah.
What's your view on entrepreneurs that try to do that? And like, you know, you've had the experience of running one company for
years,
and that's hard enough.
So I think
how much do you actually believe that they're really running all of those? Maybe Elon Musk, but I really don't think Jack Dorsey does shit at Twitter. I think he just focuses on Square.
So I think there's a lot of different types of entrepreneur, and you know, those types of people, they're clearly talking in terms of big dreams and big goals, and they're steering their company, but they're not there, you know, deep in the detail, you know, certainly not in the operational detail every day. And that's fine. That's another type of entrepreneur. You know, the trick is with those is don't screw it up, right? If you're caught with businesses failing because you were distracted, that's, you know, that's the worst. But if you can pull it off, then why not? You know, why not give that high level steering to multiple companies?
Do you agree, Rich?
Well, I have a hard enough job running one company.
It does seem quite unfathomable, doesn't it? But I mean, I guess the reality is, and I've thought about exactly this as well, is that, you know, without taking away a lot of the credit that founders should get, but really, if you've got a great COO, they end up doing a lot of the really tough heavy lifting. So if you had amazing operations people in every one of those businesses, you probably could take a higher level step back potentially.
You can, but there's it's a really good article that was doing the rounds a couple of years ago about, or maybe it was more recent, of is Tim Cook turning into Steve Ballmer? You know, is he the really solid operational guy who became CEO and is milking the company for all the growth and profit it can get to, but without ever taking it to a visionary new place?
There's no creativity.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, you can be that visionary CEO dabbling, and you've got to have that really, really solid operational layer. But the problem is, if you let the company just be run by that operational layer without giving the visionary input, then it'll eventually run out of steam.
Yeah. I mean, it's teamwork at the end of the day, correct?
Yeah.
Did you have a mentor help you along the way at all?
No one person, but I think, you know, I'm kind of a really strong believer now in serendipity, and being successful in creating a company and it thriving it feels like there's a lot of luck involved and a lot of hard work, but the serendipity piece is really important. I think I was lucky enough that there were lots of people that kind of fell into my lap that were useful to us and advised me really well. And it wasn't just chance. It was kind of building those connections, getting out and talking to people a lot, remembering one tiny little fact that a year later becomes useful. And so there's been lots of people along the way that have really helped us advance. And so I remember, for example, one of our investors and board members at Photobox, Jean-Marc Boulier, he said to me that when you put two companies together, there has to be a kind of really simple statement. And it always starts with the words, it's really simple. You know, company A does this, but doesn't do this. And company B, you know, complements that. And if you can wrap up that transaction in that really simple statement, it'll work. And if you can't, if it takes you, you know, 6 pages or 30 pages of PowerPoint to explain why this merger should happen, it's never going to happen. That's always been good advice to me as well.
Yeah, that's very solid advice. It's quite a hot topic at the moment with, I guess you might consider this a more modern, fluffy entrepreneur's dilemma, but a lot being made on sort of mental fortitude of the ups and downs and how people manage it, and lots of tricks like meditation and stuff. Have you ever been into any of those things? Have you ever sort of recognized any sort of depression, mental illness? Have you always been happy? Like, how can you sort of look back on your journey in that kind of way?
So I think I've always been almost unnaturally positive, and I do tend towards happiness quite a lot, but I get very stressed at times. So whilst I have a very positive belief that good things, you know, celebrate good things and bad things can be turned around, and, you know, whatever is going wrong, any kind of crisis, you make a list of all the things you're going to do about it, and you start at the top and work your way down. That's all cool, but I did get really super stressed. And I remember after the merger of the UK and the French business in 2006, I lobbied to create a single platform for the group. And about a year into this, in 2007, I realized I'd bitten off far more than I could chew. It was turning out to be a horrible project, you know, really delayed, consuming huge amounts of resource, not really, I wasn't confident it was going to get there anytime soon. And I just remember being stressed all the time. And even though at the time I didn't kind of recognize it, it was, I just started having palpitations and ended up in hospital. And thought, this is crazy. I'm like, I've got to do something about this stress. And I just started to take more effort in exercise, swimming, drinking less coffee, just kind of recognizing the physical needs as well as the mental needs, and that definitely helped. And I
feeling guilty about that coffee I gave you this morning now.
No, I drink lots of coffee now, and it's working fine. But I exercise a lot these days. I run, I swim, and I don't feel at all guilty about taking that hour out of my day, because I think it kind of contributes to overall productivity and good outcome.
Yeah, absolutely. So people say that entrepreneurs are crazy. Do you feel like you're crazy, or have you ever felt like you're crazy?
I think you have to be a bit irrational, right? If you there's a quote by George Bernard Shaw that says something about the rational man fits himself to the world around him, and the irrational man seeks to change the world to his needs. Mm-hmm. And I think that's absolutely true. You know, if you just accept the status quo, you don't innovate, you don't become an entrepreneur. So you have to be a bit irrational. And then probably 9 out of 10 of us are so irrational, it's off the scale and doesn't work. And then some of us are a little bit anchored. But I think you have to be a little bit different to everyone else.
Rich, would you consider yourself an anchor?
No.
I said anchor. Yeah? Okay, you're right.
Yes, in that case.
Okay, good. So you seem like, and obviously I've spent some time with you, so it's not even seem like, you just are a very jovial, I guess, happy and glass half full kind of guy, like you say. And obviously, yeah, you got full reason to be, and it's not like I met you 10 years ago when things were a lot more stressful, but you don't really seem like you have that many bugbears, but you must do because you are human. So what pisses you off?
What pisses me off? So even though I've talked to you about relaxation and, you know, not getting too stressed, I still move everywhere really quickly. I walk quickly. People always criticize me. Somebody called me rocket legs, which is ridiculous. But, you know, it annoys me when we move too slowly. And I think what annoys me most of all of anything in the world is people in front of me walking slowly, quite wide on the pavement with a wheelie bag. Because you just can't get past them.
That does sound really
and maybe that's a metaphor for life, you know, people that are blocking the path and going slowly. So
have you seen that video of the person with the bike?
I have. I want one of those. I think I should get
this
one of those.
Got this bike bell, and if they've got a slow walking person, they just ring the bike bell, you know, they're like, ring ring. Yeah. And the people move, they naturally are like, oh, get out of the way.
That is brilliant. I want that. Yeah. And of course, you had to come via Liverpool Street today, and those escalators are stuffed full of those kind of people.
Yes, well,
you very know, frustrating.
I took that as a moment of mindfulness coming up the escalator.
Yeah, breathing out nice and slowly. What's been the biggest mistake you've made in business?
I don't think there's been one kind of big mistake. The big mistake would have been doing something that destroyed the company. I think, like I say, a kind of regret is that we didn't go faster in the first 5 years, but no big mistake.
Okay, that's a very good thing and confident to be able to say, but obviously that makes it true. What's the weirdest story from your photo box days? Can you share any potentially odd stories that I might know of?
There could be some weird photos.
Weird photos is a separate question, Rich. You're jumping the good stuff, so that we get both answers out of Graham.
Should have read this out.
Yeah, exactly. So Graham, tell us the weird story first.
I just think people are weird. You know, people we've employed at times have just off the scale, and you know, employees going AWOL and then finding out they've been arrested, or
we need to interview them for that.
Nothing. I can't think at the moment. You're putting me on the spot, but I can't think of the one big story. But no, there's been lots of little funny things.
Anyone found to be sleeping in your dark room?
No, there's been very little of that kind of activity that I know about. But so should we do the photos one?
Yeah,
then? I'm just trying to think what I can.
I mean, you've got some great photo stories. There was the German one, if I recall.
The German one. You have to remind me what that was. Have I told you that in a pub somewhere?
The calendar, the one where the
Germans... Oh, yeah. So Germans, yeah. So there's different country attitudes to nudity, and we were always very sensitive about it in the UK, Mark and I, because we were trying to position ourselves as family friendly, and we were constantly trying to do deals with ISPs that were, you know, had this family friendly policy. So we were like zero tolerance on nudity. And we used to, in fact, have on our back office screen where you could kind of see orders going through and stuff, there would be a little ticker of photos being uploaded because there was quite small volume at the time. And your eye would sometimes, if people were uploading, personal bedroom activity photos, your eye gets drawn to it quite quickly. And also they don't upload just one, they upload like 40 of them. So you'd see this little ticker going through and you click on it and then go, okay, we're going to nuke that account or have a quiet word with them or something. But when we moved into Europe, we realized that lots of German people produce nude calendars at Christmas. So we had to kind of get more used to it.
And the weirdest thing you've ever had printed on...
I don't know. We have lots of emotional stories, you know, pictures of dead people that they're, you know, and it always seems to be those orders that go wrong, you know, like not that a lot go wrong, but, you know, it's always the case where customer services hears from a lady who's got a recently deceased relative and they're putting together these prized pictures from over the years and we've screwed up the order in some way and we have to get it to them quickly. So lots of that stuff. But, you know, we're dealing with people's memories and emotions, and it's not just that ink and paper thing.
You've always been very conscious of that.
Yeah, yeah.
And always let people know that actually it's actually printed. Someone will see it.
Yeah, yeah. We used to also get people that would kind of test our nudity policy by embedding... you know, very saucy pictures in the middle of a normal batch. And when somebody kind of flicks through them just to check the quality, that's when they spot it. So
what's your biggest personality flaw?
Biggest personality flaw? Probably too trusting. I kind of take people on face value. And if somebody...
Has that been a problem for you in the past, or have you been lucky to get away with that?
I think in work, I've been lucky enough to get away with it. Very few people have... really screwed things up. I think personally I've been a bit naive. I've been one of those people that bought a phone on eBay a few years ago for my son. Yeah, right. And that didn't work out.
Okay, fine. What's the best piece of advice you've ever been given? And it can't be a George Bernard Shaw quote.
Best piece of advice? I don't know. There's not one single one. I just had great advice from people over the years. And
this is Nick Leeson. Don't do what he did.
I can't really recall. I just think, always kind of sit back, assess a situation and decide what you want to do next. Don't do a kind of knee-jerk reaction. Mm. But I've been lucky enough to have really smart people around me as well.
So what's the best piece of advice you'd give to young entrepreneurs that are starting off on their journey now?
I think it's really sort out in their mind why they're trying to do it. Do they want to be an entrepreneur or do they want to solve a problem that's visible to them in their lives? I think it's really difficult to say, I'm going to be an entrepreneur, I'm going to find a business model, you know, I'm going to go out there and create a business. I think it's far better to feel passionately about something, a problem you want to solve. And if they haven't got that problem they want to solve, then perhaps don't go and sit in WeWork. Get a normal job, build up your experience, build up your contacts. Let your mind have a bit of time to form what you need to do. Don't try and force it. I think it's difficult to force it. That's the point.
I think that's great advice. Like looking back, there were certainly times when for our first business, I was just thinking, you know what would have been brilliant is getting a 9-to-5 job I didn't give a shit about and sitting there and doing the bare minimum, but having a salary and spending time on the thing I wanted to do. And it actually frees up a lot of the pressure as well.
Yeah.
So I think that's actually got something off to...
Well, you could even... George Spencer from Rentify, I don't know if you've heard of Rentify, they're doing... They help landlords essentially manage their properties. He was working in advertising and wanted to learn more about the property market because he saw an opportunity there. And so he left, and everyone thought it was bizarre because he left this good job in advertising and then worked at Foxton's as an estate agent just because it was a salary and he wanted to learn. Yeah, about how
right, go get a job in the industry. Exactly. You're interesting. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it's all too easy from the outside to say I'm going to disrupt an industry which you know nothing about, absolutely, and then you go in there and people say, yeah, but there's already a solution for that. Yeah. So yeah.
And I also find that there's a lot of like lingo terminology in a lot of industries where our business is in the restaurant industry, and both my co-founder and I weren't involved in restaurants, and for the first year or 18 months of our business, kept calling stuff wrong, like different to what the restaurant, instead of
wait, that's a main course.
But like they don't call it restaurant chains is not a thing, it's like operators, they call them operators, and instead of restaurants they call them sites,
right?
So just like stuff like that is just, yeah, kind of
that's like an e-commerce when it's like merchants, and it's like merchants, yeah, how old, exactly, is that, but that's what they call them.
But you wonder why you're not getting any sales. It's like these guys that have no idea about your business coming, yeah, in, so it takes a while to pick that up.
Just to wrap up, if you could start all over again, would you rather a sustainable, profitable business in year one or a high-growth tech startup all over again?
So I've done the conservative, slow-growth thing, so I'd have to go for the second option.
Interesting. But would you actually do that? Or is this like, I know this is a hypothetical, but just taking it further out of interest, is that something that you would consider doing?
So I'd like to think that I've got enough experience now to accelerate a good idea. I don't think I would be the one to come up with the idea and to be there on absolute day one, but to come into something where it's, you know, a small number of people, perhaps they've had some seed funding and they're definitely pre-series A. Yeah, and love to. I'm working with a number of startups at the moment, just kind of as an informal advisor, and the best ones are where the opportunities there and everything's on the up, and actually they can't even figure out quite what business model they want to follow yet. They've got so many different directions to go in. I think that's a really exciting time, and that's somewhere where I think I could help, because I can help steer them on what might work and not work.
And would it be B2B or B2C, or does it just not matter? It's more about the challenge if it's interesting.
Yeah, it doesn't really matter, but you know, I know a lot about B2C at this stage, but also there's a lot about e-commerce that's kind of infuriating. It's kind of locked in a certain model in some way, so it might be nice to try something that's slightly outside of that core e-commerce model.
So on a very related subject then, would you do another business in e-commerce and content, or would you do anything else other than that?
I'm very open-minded, and we'll see what the future holds, but for the moment I'm still at Photobox.
Sure. No, but I'm not pressing you on this. Does your gut feel like you do e-commerce all over again, or is it like, you know what, I don't know anything about and something else, and therefore that's more interesting. Yeah, anything.
I think I'd like to, you know, if I was picking from a menu, I would pick something that makes a difference to people's lives but isn't about selling them stuff through a shopping cart.
Cool. Would you raise money from investors you don't get on with at all, or fail?
If it's that or failure, yeah, I'd raise it from them and I'd learn to work with them. I think, you know, investors are people that you have to understand what their motives are, what they need, and you have to keep them well fed with information and, you know, rational choices, or explain to them the choices you're making. But I've also seen startups that are paralyzed by toxic investors who are just like, it's burn the house down, you know, get what I want or burn the house down. And I think that's a really tough situation to be in. I really feel for them when they're in that situation.
Would you start with the same co-founder, different co-founder, or no co-founder?
I would love to work with Mark again. I don't think Mark wants to do another startup. So, yeah, again, I'd be open. I like working with people with complementary skills who I feel will toe the line, you know, contribute and are smart. So whoever, yeah.
And finally, would you start it in the UK again, mainland Europe or the USA?
Having traveled to Paris every week for 9 years, I'm kind of keen on not doing a lot of travel. I love London. I love living in London. I think there's enough exciting here stuff going on here, even post-Brexit. I'd love to do something quite close to home.
So I thought you were going to say France, and I was going to say, well, if you're lucky, Marine Le Pen will be in soon. You won't be able to recognize France, Britain, or America. So
yeah, there's not a particularly great tax regime in France for entrepreneurs.
No, very true. Very true. Okay, well, so concludes a fantastic session with a man who's certainly been through his fair share of ups and downs. I guess if I could really comment on the one key thing that struck me talking to Graham, it's actually that his original intention with his co-founder Mark was to be a small, sustainable business. they didn't really have any aspirations towards exit, at least not in the early days. And that's precisely what led them to be a credible, profitable and growing business, which in the end attracted suitable acquirers. So that's a lesson for you, Rich, you greedy so-and-so. That organic nature of growing your business was ultimately the very thing that led to such explosive growth. But equally, it's really a story of patience and loving what you do rather than seeking an outcome. That's definitely food for thought for budding entrepreneurs there. So thank you very much to Graham. Now, Rich, why don't you let us know what kind of information and what kind of person we've got on next week's episode?
Well, Dan, we'll be recording from none other than the world-famous Buckingham Palace in an exciting and extremely rare interview with Her Majesty the Queen's son, Prince Andrew.
Oh, yes. Well, he's not really known as an entrepreneur in the typical sense, I guess. So why have we actually chosen him?
Well, actually, he is a founder. He's the founder of something called Pitch at Palace, which is a global event seeking out the best entrepreneurs in the country. And you know him because you actually did Pitch at Palace.
That is a fact. Thank you very much for the plug, Rich. Anyway, please join us next week and subscribe on iTunes, Google Play Music, SoundCloud and or YouTube, whatever tickles your fancy. And you can catch up with everything that you might have missed and more on www.secretleaders.com. See you next time.